previously on We Live Here.
I got pushed out for what? No reason.
The racial segregation that we see everywhere in this country is the product of very explicit design.
Yes, I'd be known for doing, changing the law. I mean, that would be great, though, because it would be helping a lot of people who are less fortunate.
Hey guys, it's me, Camille.
And me, Tim, and we are enjoying some beautiful weather here in St. Louis by doing the thing that people like to do when it's beautiful outside in St. Louis, taking a stroll through the very, very posh Central West End.
Yes, it's a cool place for people of a certain type, and we're on Euclid.
We are on Euclid, and we're with a good friend of ours. Well, kind of with a
kind of. He's with us.
Yeah, hey Rico, what's up, man?
Hey, Tim. Hey, Camille.
Hey, so Rico is our project manager at PRX, and he's actually in California right now, which is why we just called him up on FaceTime, and he's, like, walking with us.
Yeah, so a couple of months ago, Rico, you were in town, right, visiting a coworker of ours, and you came up to this particular street, and we're like, what is that?
Yeah, so this is my first time in St. Louis as an adult. I can't help but notice these large stone walls and ornate iron gates, and so I was asking my coworker, who's lived in St. Louis for a while, I was like, you know, what's going on with these streets here? And he explained that, you know, these are gated communities, and I'd never seen anything quite like this in the city before.
Right, when you think about gated communities, you're like, oh, that's like a big, like, development around a golf course or something like that.
Yeah, it's a suburban thing.
Yeah, totally. For a long time, Rico, you were calling us up and saying, you know, during our planning calls, you guys got to do something on gated streets. And we were like,
eh. Yeah, we weren't too much
not,
into
not
it
feeling
at first.
It, really.
We were like, it's a St. Louis thing. I don't know. And then we were like, but wait, maybe there is an interesting story here.
Fortunately, I am very persistent.
Yes.
You are very persistent.
He persisted. And so we did some research, and it turns out there actually is a really interesting reason why we have these closed gated streets in St. Louis. And actually, we were kind of like, we kind of pioneered the map.
Rico, we brought you to this street to tell you that on this episode, we are telling you the story of gated communities, past, present, and maybe the future in St. Louis.
All right, I'm all ears.
You want to do the tagline, dude?
Let's do it.
From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
A podcast for people somewhere on the woke spectrum.
Oh, you're good at that, man.
I've been practicing.
Figuring out the story of gated streets in St. Louis and their legacy is like pulling on one very, very, very long string.
And what's ultimately revealed is a tangled web of wealth, racism, privilege, and policy. Fortunately for us, though, we've got a guy in St. Louis named Michael Allen who's willing to help us out.
Hey!
Hey.
How are ya?
Good.
What's up?
Michael's made a name for himself as the go-to preservationist in the city, and he lectures at Washington University here in St. Louis.
We met up with him at a street called Benton Place in the historic Lafayette Square neighborhood.
This is the prototype. These tools shape something beautiful, but they also shape something ugly at the same time. A little residential cul-de-sac that most St. Louisans have probably never walked down.
Let's walk.
I mean, these homes are beautiful.
Beautifully restored, nice tree canopy. Every front yard seems to have a well-manicured garden. These are large houses built generally before and after the Civil War, in the Gilded Age. It's got a few other stories to tell, too.
The rich in America, Michael explains, used to live in city centers.
A couple blocks from where they worked, a couple blocks from where their furniture was being manufactured, a couple blocks from where their workers lived.
But as cities became more industrialized, Michael says the wealthiest in the country wanted to create exclusive enclaves away from pollution and streets covered in horse manure.
There had been urban fires as well. St. Louis had one in 1849 that wiped out most of the center of the riverfront. Chicago would have one in 1871.
Now, back in this time, there weren't any zoning laws. So developers thought to themselves, no biggie.
So to create an exclusive enclave, the developers had to turn to the state General Assembly to create a state law prohibiting any industry within 300 feet of this park.
They also introduced another new idea to St. Louis, deed restrictions, to control what could and could not be built here, and of course, who could and who could not live here.
To use architecture to control the class of people who would live here. And of course, those restrictions were also racialized as well. And after the city adopted zoning, deed restrictions would be used primarily to restrict the migration of African Americans throughout the city. That's a story that comes from here.
Rich white people really liked Benton Place.
The smallness of Benton Place wasn't enough for the families of this class.
Julius Pitzman, who designed Benton Place, would go on to create more than 45 private streets.
And at the turn of the century, Pitzman's vision was scaled up in a major way at our next stop, a subdivision called Parkview Place.
So we are driving past the crown jewel of St. Louis, as it is called often, Forest Park.
Forest Park. We're right on the edge, just about 300 feet from the county line.
This was home to the 1904 World's Fair.
People here in St. Louis.
People
talk
in
about
St.
It
Louis
all
talk about
the
it.
Time.
Yes.
This was the country, even when the World's Fair was taking place.
But that would soon change after the elite Washington University announced it was moving its campus from downtown St. Louis to be near the new massive park.
This signaled that the elite of the city had decided that their new enclave was going to be west. Right. And on the edge of the park.
I just picked one of these, by the way, just to kind of turn left on.
Yeah.
And in 1905, work began to lay out Parkview Place.
Parkview is different than Benton Place in that you still enter through gates, but Benton Place, there are houses that face out at the entrance.
Yeah, and speaking of
here, we're
looking at a big no outlet sign right there. Yeah.
And it's a big stone wall. There's no interface to the rest of the community.
The model that was a single gated cul-de-sac at Benton Place will be turned into a sprawling development with more than 250 homes.
It's like taking Benton Place and its surrounding neighborhood and turning it all into the protected enclave.
But that wouldn't be enough.
What was on the other side of Del Mar was a horse racing track where thousands of people would come every weekend and get drunk and watch horses race.
No kidding.
So how would you get rich people to build the kinds of houses we're seeing right now on a piece of land like that? Well, first you have to protect it from the railroads and the horse track. Then you have to give it something special, something scenic. So that's why Julius Pitzman, who laid this out, he decided to make all these streets curve, plant them with these tall trees, so it seemed like you were living inside of some special park or botanical garden.
And this enchanted-feeling neighborhood would come with the same deed restrictions that were perfected at Benton Place just after the Civil War.
You're buying a house here, you're guaranteed that your neighbor has to build the same kind of house that you are living in. It has to be of the same class and race. So this is whites only until the 1940s and 50s. And they perfect the measures. I mean, this is really hard still to get in and out of, right? Even Benton Place is easier and more transparent. There's one way in and one way out. None of those sidewalks connect. So not only can you not get out on these pedestrian paths to Del Mar, but you can't even go to that other neighborhood on the other side, which is also middle class and upper middle class.
And while the houses themselves might not be as big, this development model got bigger and bigger and bigger after the Second World War.
Yeah, no more open street grids. Everything would be sort of curved, and there would be limited access in and out of developments. There's rules about what you can build, what you can't build, how big your house has to be, how big your lot has to be.
It's a familiar sight today to see such communities erected on what once were just wide open spaces. And all of this has been accomplished by...
This is a film by the National Association of Home Builders from that period talking about how great this housing boom is for the economy.
Now there are shopping centers, well-paved streets, parks, play areas, and sports facilities.
And the federal government backed these new developments.
In fact, the Federal Housing Authority subsidized these massive subdivisions with the explicit condition that homes were only sold to whites.
On top of that, in our region, a flood of new municipalities were being created in St. Louis County, and they were writing the rules however they wanted.
And all of this brings us to our next stop.
Well, we're on Canfield Drive in Ferguson. We're just a few yards from where Darren Wilson shot Michael Brown.
Do you want to walk over to that spot?
Sure. A plaque in the sidewalk marks this event, the life of Michael Brown.
Just a few years before the Canfield Green apartment complex was built, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled, in a case from St. Louis, that racial discrimination in private housing sales was unconstitutional.
The second wave that came after these little houses was this wave of FHA-backed and HUD-backed apartment complexes that would be open theoretically to everyone. But there was a lot of animosity toward this development type, and a lot of municipalities were created in North County around here expressly to pass zoning laws that forbade multiple dwellings, thinking, well, if we can't now openly racially discriminate, we can at least, you know, discriminate against renters, and that might do some of the trick of creating these separate communities.
One of the most infamous examples comes from the North St. Louis County Municipality of Blackjack, which incorporated to prevent the development of a low-income housing complex.
But in 1974, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that what Blackjack did constituted racial discrimination.
You know, all that kind of coalesces here, that we have the restrictions, but we also have these apartment buildings, which, as generic as they are, represented some attempt to integrate racially and economically the suburbs of St. Louis, following all these decades of segregation, oppression, and manipulation of law. So it's like these were pretty hopeful buildings at the time they were built in a lot of ways.
In a lot of ways, these are also coming from the where we started in the city, and in the early gated communities, there aren't gates here. But you're saying that the barriers that exist were very real, but in a lot of ways invisible to the naked eye.
Mm-hmm. Right, and you know, originally this subdivision street stopped mm-hmm. before it was extended to Canfield. So you know, it's like the street literally ended, and if you keep going, the streets keep ending.
The lack of through streets would later play a big role in the protests following the 2014 killing of Michael Brown.
That's because when police tried to disperse crowds with tear gas, rubber bullets, flash grenades, people didn't have anywhere to go. None of the streets were connected through an open street grid.
Coming up, we keep pulling on this thread of gated streets as it morphs from a closed street to a city enclave, to a county suburb, to an entirely new kind of town.
Craft a new world where the suburbs could become more like the old neighborhoods, where people would have to look into each other's eyes as they walked out their front doors in the morning.
Before we get to our next stop with Michael, we need to take you guys on a bit of a virtual detour. More specifically, to a little town in the Florida Panhandle.
In the late 1970s, developer Robert Davis inherited 80 acres there and set out to create an entirely new town to look like an old town. It will be called Seaside, and it would become the poster child for a planning concept called New Urbanism.
In fact, the developers did such a good job creating this highly stylized version of the past that the town literally became the movie set for the 1998 film The Truman Show.
What if your world was make-believe?
Cue the sun.
While the world he inhabits is counterfeit.
I'm not allowed to talk to you.
That's how I look. Not your type.
There's nothing fake about Truman himself.
In the early 2000s, the same company that developed Seaside in Florida would bring their model to Missouri.
Except it would be 9 times bigger and built in neighboring St. Charles County, about a 30-minute drive northwest of the Canfield Green Apartments in Ferguson.
They call it Newtown. And we'd never been out there before we put together this episode.
1,000 feet, turn left onto Domain Street.
Driving toward the chapel in the middle of this massive development, the size and scope of the project, it's hard to ignore.
right down to the little details.
Look, there's an old, like, it looks like a, like an old gas light with a flame in it. Can you believe it?
This is amazing. And it's all made up.
Is yeah, right. All of this is new.
Wow.
I don't even know what to think right now. This is crazy.
Oh, look, we've made it. We've made it to
church. This is the church, yeah.
We've made it to church.
Sort of tiny Romanesque church, sort of like you might find in a small Italian town, you know?
Except with that giant cell tower.
Well, yeah, these little postmodern details.
Yeah. Except for the cell tower on top of the church.
There's a custom dog biscuit little store.
Well, you can't have a new town without a custom dog biscuit place, can you?
No, you can't.
And it's literally called New Town.
It's a new town. A town from nothing.
I'm guessing what was here before were those fields that when you come in, it's just farmland right across the street.
Like right. All farmland. And we're, you know, about five miles from the heart of St. Charles, which is an older urban city that does have old French architecture and German architecture that this is trying to emulate. But there's no connection between the city of St. Charles and Newtown. Newtown is remote. Over here you see a roofline that could remind us like of Soulard.
Yeah. Right.
Right?
Yeah.
We have the little...
Well, of Lafayette Square.
Lafayette Square. You have the dormers and the double chimneys.
Yeah.
The old-fashioned divided light windows. You can clearly see that the developers here were reaching to St. Louis City for some of the inspiration for this project, but placing it as far away as possible from the core of the city.
The ultimate
picturesque garden suburb fantasy. You know, it's blending the very old architecture of Benton Place with the sort of spatial planning we saw at Parkview and Canfield. So you're literally, you know, taking the old city, or the image of the old city, and then reassembling it as a suburban landscape. Newtown flagged a little bit after the recession, but you go out today and you're coming in off of Highway 370 and there's just oodles of new houses going up.
Developers recently added 160 acres to Newtown, room to build 850 new homes starting next year.
But Michael says the desires that built Newtown and what used to be farm fields have also pushed back into the city of St. Louis.
A lot of people who want this way of life but actually want to be in the central city, their impulses may be similar though. They probably want a protected, fancy, you know, brand new house with all the trimmings. So these are people who are putting more demands on neighborhoods to make them more like this. They want the traditional urbanism, but they still want the security measures. They still want quiet streets. There are people who may or may not object to street closures.
And this is where we turn around and travel 30 miles back into the heart of the city.
So we just got to the Grove area, which is rapidly changing very, very quickly.
Oh, here we go.
We're looking for some balls right and some pots.
It's kind of weird. You think maybe a concrete eagle, you know, laid some eggs or something. But
or something.
Yes.
Michael is talking about what people in St. Louis sometimes call sleigh balls, after former Mayor Francis Slay, who served the longest term in the city's history.
Slay's administration continued the decades-long practice of closing off previously open streets to traffic.
First, it was culvert pipes, then big concrete pots.
And under Slay, many were replaced with giant concrete balls, hence Slay balls.
So this is a working class street, but at the end of it, we have a street closure.
Let's go check it out.
But here we have a miniature Benton Place in the making, right?
The architect for this concept was a man by the name of Oscar Newman, who published a book in the early 1970s called Defensible Space.
He would later join the faculty at Washington University, the same elite institution that anchored the Parkview Place development you heard about earlier in the episode.
He studied the patterns of urban poverty and crime at Pruitt-Igoe and on neighborhood streets and thought that the most defensible kind of space where people would feel psychologically the safest was a closed access street. He also, though, did say that he got the idea from Benton Place and other streets. One of the things he noticed was that those streets tended to be safer, and they tended not to have the abandoned buildings and trash in the front lawns that he's seen everywhere around the city.
They also tended to be pretty white.
They were pretty white. He never really talked about race, and in fact, he posed as this kind of savior, you know, for poor and minority communities. It was a very paternalistic attitude. But he thought these closed streets had some attributes that neighborhoods could have. That, you know, this open grid was slowing down efforts to renew neighborhoods. And that if you close these streets, that people would flock to these closed streets because they'd be more like Benton Place. They'd also be more like the streets in the suburbs that people, both black and white, were moving to in the 70s in North County, in South County, West County.
He got city officials to try it.
City officials to try it. And then after a while, the aldermen and neighborhood associations were pushing for it.
Why didn't it work here? Why wasn't he able to flip this into the Benton Park of his dreams and what he thought the city would need?
Newman ignored a lot of the real sort of structural problems in the city. He didn't seem to invest in the long-term deprivation of wealth and credit to working class and minority populations, that a lot of the reasons these streets had fallen in disrepair was not because of the condition of the street itself, but because they had been redlined out of any access to meaningful credit by the federal government in the 1930s and eventually by the banks in St. Louis. You know, the same forces are still at play. The only reason the neighborhoods, all these buildings are really improving today is that you're finding the kind of people that have never had their credit and wealth denied to them, affluent people and white people, they're coming into the neighborhood and they're able to bring money and invest in these buildings, buy them, renovate them. You know, it's like, so these really didn't seem to have much of a difference at all, except to keep some people out of certain blocks.
Meanwhile, a familiar pattern is beginning to emerge on the streets surrounding us in the Grove.
Gentrification happens slow in St. Louis, but it still happens. Look at the census data and you'll see more white, more affluent people are moving to this area. Lower income and people of color, they're being pushed out.
And as each of these buildings gets renovated, the land values rise. The homeowners here who are sticking it out are having higher property tax bills. Everybody else is watching their rent go out, but the values are getting so high where landlords can make more money flipping these to people, turning them into townhouses, than renting them out to average people.
And while the physical manifestations used in St. Louis and elsewhere to restrict spaces for certain people have morphed, gotten bigger, or retrofitted for once open streets, Michael says a narrative remains constant.
Wealth, whiteness, we've seen that play out across the city in the construction of these closed streets. We've seen that in the suburbs, and we've seen that in the impulse to close streets that were once open in the city. It's the same philosophy. And it's hard to say if it's dying out or not. You know, there's a lot of interest in urbanism today and open street grids, but there's still closures and it's still proven impossible to reverse any of these. None of them have really gone away.
Next time on We Live Here.
I always come in like 30 minutes before they come just so I can check things out, make sure the house still there, first of all. Make sure that no rodents, no dead bodies, no whatever else. whatever else come with vacant houses. So I always do an exterior walk around, make sure it's safe. That's why I tell people when they come to wear boots. As you see, it's glass, beer bottles, tires, and there's kids playing right across from it. So that just lets you know how damage in a vacant house can be on a community.
We Live Here is produced by me, Tim Lloyd.
And me, Camille Stanley.
Alana Sistrunk is our associate producer.
And Robert Peterson is our boss. He's the director of radio programming here at St. Louis Public Radio.
And from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PRX.